Good evening. I'm Just Plain Bill, and this is Weekly Conservative Talk. Another hour of Weekly Conservative Talk for you. Just to clear things up from last week, I talked a lot last week about perverse incentives. And from my perspective, a perverse incentive is an incentive that does not accomplish and, in fact, works against your intended output. A virtuous incentive is an incentive that is congruent with your intended output. So just so that we have that clear, I wanted you to know that, because I may talk about that just a little bit more tonight as we go forward. I have with me Greg W. Howard, and Greg and I are going to talk a little bit about, one, the Great Depression, and two, are there any parallels with today, and three, what does that mean in terms of generational changes, changes in thinking that impact entire generations? And the apocryphal story is this. I grew up listening to my mom and dad. My grandparents didn't really talk about it, but listening to my mom and dad. And they were probably 6 and 10 when the Great Depression started in 1929. But they told stories about grandmother and granddad and the money that they lost because there was no FDIC insurance in those days, and how that affected not only my grandparents' thinking, but how that affected their thinking and what that meant to them. So, having said that, let me bring Greg on in here and say, we obviously are in deep economic problems. I mean, you can look at the statistics and you can say, yep, by golly, the signs are there for everybody to see. So the question becomes, how does that change anybody's thinking? What happens to, one, the me generation? What happens to the people who said, oh yeah, buy now, pay later? What happens to those people who said, I want to try and put something away for my older age, and have found that in putting it away in the stock market, they have suffered perhaps not catastrophic, but serious losses? What do you think, Greg?
Well, it's indeed a paradigm shift of what we've been taught all our lives about buy and hold investing. Mm-hmm. There was always, I remember in my early days of training in the financial industry, they would gladly point to ever since the Great Depression, there was no 10-year period where the stock market didn't finish higher. Mm-hmm. But now we have one. If you
yes,
go
we
from
do.
1999 to now, we're indeed lower than where we were in 1999, and that's 11 years ago. So we are sitting at a lower point. It changes how we look at real estate. For several generations, the home has always been the traditional store of value, something that you could pay into all your life for 30 years. You know, get the kids grown, kick them out, send them off to college, do whatever you want, then parlay the home into a motor home or sell it and buy a condo on the beach or simply move into a smaller apartment and have some cash to live on the rest of your life. That indeed has changed. And by the way, we're nowhere near the bottom of the housing market yet. I was looking at some information from Case Shiller, and it looks like we may have another 50% down to go in some markets. Now, that's not every market. Every market's a little bit different. Obviously, some properties will still always have a little bit more desirability to them, and others did not run up nearly as crazy as the ones in, say, for Las Vegas or California. Here in Alabama, for example, homes did not run up nearly as much, so they've not retraced nearly as much. And they seem to have found some sort of stability, even though selling times are much longer, especially if you get over 120,000 in this market.
You know, that
remember, 120,000 is a lot of house here.
Yes, it is. You know, that brings up an interesting point. I saw an article last week that said, and it's a town in Florida, that the average income is $56,000 a year, and houses are selling for $57,000. And that just boggled my mind. I mean, the old rule of thumb was you could afford a house that was about three times your average annual salary.
That's what we were always taught. And then, of course, you know, he got as many as 10 times with some of these crazy interest-only mortgages.
Yep.
That boggles my mind.
Yes, it does. And real estate isn't the only thing that was a store in value. It was probably the surest, although it was not liquid. But you knew that within 6 months to a year, you were going to be able to sell it. You were going to be able to pull dollars out of it and then go do whatever it was that you wanted to do. In fact, I remember when I was a kid that people in the neighborhood would have mortgage burning ceremonies. And you don't hear about that now. I mean, this isn't a time when, or at least it wasn't a time when, people said, I'm going to invest in my house, I'm going to have a place to live, I'm going to have a roof over my head, and when I pay off the mortgage, I'm going to have a party over that. Now it's, gee, I wonder when I can flip it. Wonder when I can move up to the next thing so that I can flip it. And that seems to me to be a concept that is going to change. It may not have changed yet. I mean, I still see people out there saying, oh, God, now's a great time to get into real estate. Look at all of these foreclosures that are on the market. You can buy them and then flip them.
That tells me that a bottom has not been achieved. Using basic market psychology, and I'm a big student of market psychology through the use of Elliott waves, and Elliott waves are simply a study of price pattern in markets, and if you're interested, you can go to ElliottWave.com and get a lot of information on it for free. But anyway, market psychology, when you hear, for example, gold is in a bit of a bubble right now, but and the way you tell is everybody's screaming buy gold, buy gold, buy gold. Now, remember back in 2000, every other ad on TV was about day trading.
Yes.
That's how you tell if you're in a bubble. And that's how you tell you have not reached a bottom yet, is when there's still bullish sentiment out there, as there is in real estate. You still hear the ads on Sirius Radio during the day. I'll teach you how to make millions in real estate with no cash down, blah, 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 blah. And you hear it still. When you reach a bottom is when there's absolutely no good news and people are literally vomiting at the sound of real estate or gold or whatever it may be. So we're nowhere near a bottom in the stock market. We never reached a significant, oh, woe is me, the world is doomed sentiment in the market. We haven't reached that in real estate. We haven't reached that in any of the bubbles. That means they're still unwinding.
So how does that impact people's thinking? I mean, I agree with you. We haven't reached bottoms yet. And I look at probably not as much as, but nevertheless still look at economic items that say, gosh, demand fell, manufacturing fell, housing markets still fell, prices just all of it seems to have fallen down. Savings rate is up. That's a good thing, except for consumer demand, which is 70% of the economy. So you have to stop and kind of look at that and say, how does that affect people's thinking. Mama Gurka, who I think you know on Twitter.
Quite well. Great lady.
Yeah. Yeah. Said, you know, I think we're going to see multi-generational housing. And I'm thinking, well, that's a different take than, oh, the libs are living in their mom's basement. But nevertheless, is kind of maybe an astute observation in that if people are losing their homes and if they do not have job prospects, where do they go? They live in their car, their van, their Escalade, their what? And if those are not palatable to them, and those are choices, I mean, those are choices they could make, where do they go? Now, the obvious answer in my mind may not be true, but the obvious answer is, well, they maybe hit their parents up for a living accommodations while they try and get back on their feet. What do you think?
Well, it may also be the other way around, too. It may very well be that mom and dad have to move in with the children. I can see that seniors are getting squeezed very badly right now. There was no raise in Social Security benefits last year. There will not be another one next year. Yet at the same time, Medicare premiums and co-payments all went up. At the same time, there's this great fear of what happens if the government can't make its payments. Well, what happens if mom and dad, you know, take this reverse mortgage and they do it badly and they end up losing the house? There's a lot of reasons why it actually may be that mom and dad end up coming home with the kids. But it can also work the other way around. Mom and dad actually did do well, and they're sitting there with something a little more than Social Security, and they've planned for the downturn. And the kid who can't find a job, through no fault of their own, just skills not needed at the moment, end up moving in. So I can see multi-generational and maybe even family compound type living, where, you know, even brothers and sisters, you know, may have to stack up like cordwood in bedrooms, but it's better than sleeping in the back seat of your car.
That's true. I have been in the back seat of a car before, and it's not a lot of fun, and I was a whole lot younger then. Okay, so multi-generational housing, regardless of which way the generational shift goes, seems to kind of work. What does that mean then for larger houses or houses that are able to accommodate a larger number of people? And I'm not thinking of condos. Or obviously apartments, because generally those are pretty efficient kinds of living. But in terms of houses that, regardless of whether they have some land with them, present an opportunity to accommodate more people than currently live there.
Well, we mentioned briefly at the beginning the Great Depression.
Yeah.
At the time of the Great Depression, we had a very different society. Better than half the people at the time were farmers. Therefore, they were larger. They were larger families out on more isolated pieces of land. They weren't as nearly dependent on the grocery store as we are now, with only, I think, 3% of our population actually growing the food for the rest.
Right.
And so it was not uncommon, though, for city folks to take in boarders. Many people, you know, had room for rent out in front of their houses because they needed help to make their mortgage, yet the guy who was barely surviving on day labor, or, you know, because there wasn't a lot of unemployment and social safety nets at the time, people had to band together a little bit. And this brings us to a key difference between then and now. Back then, you had more people who believed in traditional values. Generally, no one still locked their doors unless you were in a very large city. You didn't have to worry about crime. You didn't have to worry about as many things as you do today. People were not as used to the electronic luxuries and the big McMansions and everything that we've taken as almost like a right in this country. So back then, when the Depression hit and there wasn't a social safety net, people rallied around each other. They helped. Families pulled in together. You know, they heard Bill was having a bad time, and, you know, they'd take a couple hams out of the smokehouse and go over to Bill's farm and help him out.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what we have today. We have a society. Now, back then, also, farmers are very different than city folk. Farmers are used to getting all their income and food and everything at one time of year and using it for a whole year until the next harvest. City folk live from paycheck to paycheck. So as a result, we have a whole generation that doesn't know what it means to have 3 or 4 months' food in the cupboard, that has no idea what it is to make do and survive on what you have until the next harvest comes through, and heaven help you if the harvest failed. But we have a whole different way of thinking. It's a consumption economy like nothing we've ever seen. So, you know, I really fear for this country if we get into a deflationary depression, what's going to happen, because there are a number of people that just have no concept of how they're going to make it.
Well, which brings up an interesting question. What happens to the cities? What happens to the Los Angeleses and the San Franciscos and the New Yorks? Because they obviously don't have a land base to grow food on. They unfortunately have been under Democratic rule for decades. People there, not universally, I do not want to give that impression, but people there that are on the edge, and were on the edge before this whole economic crisis came down, were living at least paycheck to paycheck and probably falling behind when they did that. So the question becomes, what happens with them? I mean, do people move out of the cities? Do they, as was true in the 70s, late 60s, do they go back to the land? And do they have the skills to do that? I mean, because it's a skill. I mean, you do not decide, oh, I'm going to move out of my condo and go farm. That doesn't happen.
Well, what you've got is you've got a very dangerous situation in that scenario, and I'll explain why. Since Johnson's Great Society, there are now in some houses 3 generations in which no one's ever seen a job. They've had no need to. Everything arrived in the mailbox and now automatically deposited on a debit card. So there's no concept of doing for oneself. In fact, one can argue, and I frequently do, that it was intentional to create a dependent voting bloc. Well, as a result, now you have a bunch of people who've never known anything but dependence. They've never seen an example of self-reliance. And as a result, I mean, you could see scenarios ranging from Mad Max at Thunderdome within the cities all the way up to, you know, people banding together in churches and helping each other out as much as possible, and those that can getting out and going to live with family that live in smaller towns or whatever the case may be. I mean, every possibility in between is there. I'm afraid that some of the younger people, especially those who tend toward the gangs and the anger in the inner cities, are going to find it very rough, and they may actually, you know, have to go to marauding to find food. And remember now that since we have only 3% growing food in this country, if there's one thing the government can use to buy support and is using food as a weapon, you know, simply shutting off shipments to one area or another. If you look at the executive orders that are on file, the government has the power to do all that at any time they declare an emergency. So as a result, food can be used as a weapon against those within the cities. And also, we've also seen a great shift in generational thinking in the past 30 years to people willing to give up freedom in exchange for the security of a check, the security of not having to do anything for themselves. We have reached a point where almost half of the population doesn't pay taxes of any kind other than maybe a little bit of payroll tax. But they pay no income tax.
Right,
so
exactly.
That's what's led to our problem.
Yeah.
I didn't mean to filibuster, but I had a lot
of thoughts on my mind. No, I'm glad you did, because that brings up a number of questions that, frankly, I think we need answers to. If you live in a city, not a community, not a village, but if you live in a city where there's, theoretical mass transit, where you have grocery stores, supermarkets, you got the super Walmarts, you have all of those things. To digress just a little bit here, back when I was in the service, 1960 to 1964, it was theorized that that there was about 3 to 5 days of food supplies in our grocery stores. And as a consequence, if transportation was somehow curtailed for any appreciable length of time whatsoever, those stores would run out of foods, and at that point, food riots would occur in the cities. Now, this was at a time when we had more than just 3% growing our food. That situation has probably gotten worse at this point. So, if you live in a city, how does your thinking change, or does it? I mean, if you are dependent upon government to supply your every need, and the government, for whatever reason, is unable to fill that obligation, what do those people do? Where do they go? Who do they petition? Or do they, as you suggest, become marauders looking for simply daily sustenance?
Well, I think the answer in that is clear, that people, when pushed, will do what's necessary to survive. I mean, the stories are everywhere of people doing extreme things when pushed to the point where it's a matter of dying or surviving. Now, we've never had mass starvation in this country of any kind. Now, we've had famines, during the Dust Bowl, for example, which, helped exacerbate but people still managed to get by on very little. I mean, the diet was very different. It was much more starchy. It was a lot of beans and a lot of rice and things like that. But people managed to survive on that. We've got a very different taste to our diet, and a lot of things have changed in that regard. But I think I see a situation where the inner cities could actually become hell holes, where people are afraid to come out of their apartments, people, going door to door, shopping in other people's kitchens, for lack of a better word. It's one of the reasons why I live out in the country. I'm pretty well isolated.
Me too.
The other problem with people living in the cities is they really just don't have the space in inner city tall apartment buildings to store any significant amount of food, to get them through any disruptions in supply. So I think the cities are a horrible place to be if in that type of scenario. Now, I pray it doesn't ever get that bad, but I can see that things are not going in the right direction in any sense. And, in fact, I saw a poll today that said 84% of the population doesn't think it's going in the right direction. Oddly enough, there's 20% of the population that's liberal. So the question becomes, do they think it's not heading in the right direction because it's not going socialist enough? But regardless, we're looking at 84% of the population that says country's going in the wrong direction. So it's obvious out there. People know that it's not getting better and it's not going in the right direction at all.
So that kind of begs the question, if people understand that, what are they doing to change their behavior, if anything?
Well,
I can tell you that me personally, I have not changed, but then I have much less reason to. I have not changed my behavior other than, saying, you know what, yeah, my 32-inch TV is just fine. I don't think I need that 42-inch flat screen. My interests have gone much more to, okay, I've got this ground. I've got access to water. As long as power holds out, I can pump that. Now what else do I need to do, if anything? But people in cities don't have that. I mean, they don't even have that possibility.
They're completely dependent on all utilities. They're completely dependent on frequent deliveries to the corner grocery store. I lived in Queens, New York, for quite a few months in a tall apartment building while up there on a temporary work assignment. And you walk to the grocery store and you bring home your groceries. You don't have a car, so it's not like you can bring 25 bags of groceries home at a time anyway. So it's a whole different situation for the folks in the city. Now, out in the country, a person has more, or smaller communities, people tend to have a little bit larger house. They can certainly turn the garage into food storage. And by the way, for those listening, here are the recommendations. And if you follow them and nothing happens, nothing harmed, okay? Lay in a stock of three to 6 months' worth of canned goods and rotate your stock. When you buy a can of beans, put it in the back of the shelf and take from the front. All that will be damaged is that you'll have a little more inventory. If nothing goes wrong, you'll still have the security of food, and canned goods easily keep for a year. So if you keep rotating your stock, nothing's going to go bad there. Mm-hmm. Second of all, get yourself out of the stock market. It's throwing a nice little head fake rally right now, but to everybody with any sense at all is saying, hey, I'm out of here. In fact, $1.1 trillion has flowed out of mutual funds.
Really?
And posted a tweet on that today. They're not really sure where it went. They say some may have gone to bonds since there's been a little bit of a bull run in bonds lately. But a lot of it can't be accounted for, and they're thinking that Mr. and Mrs. America is simply paying their bills with it. The investing class of the upper middle class is now pulling the money out to keep their current expenses going. A certain amount is going into gold, as we know. And I recommend getting gold, even though its price is falling lately. Look at it as a buying opportunity. So if you follow all the recommendations, and I have a blog entry on my website at gregwhoward.com, Surviving the Collapse. If you'll follow all the advice that's in there, the worst thing that happens is you're in a stable financial condition, and you may give up some short-term gains in the stock market, but I really don't see the stock market carrying more than a couple of days higher, and then it's going to have to start heading down. The economic news is just way too bearish. In fact, today a slew of economic reports came out that were completely deflationary. No growth in consumer income, no growth in consumer spending. Savings is up. As a result, like you pointed out, we have a 70% consumer-driven economy.
Mm-hmm.
If the consumer stops spending, then there's nobody buying for these companies to make products and sell them, and as a result, more people get out of work. This is what happens. This is what causes a depression, is when the consumer stops buying, there's no need for production. As a result, the production workers are laid off. They're no longer buying, and it's a vicious cycle that heads downward.
So let's talk about that a little bit. I mean, FDR is widely acclaimed for having pulled America out of the Great Depression, that after the stock market crash of 29 and the whole grapes of wrath and the mass migrations of people out of the Midwest, out of Oklahoma, out of Nebraska, out of practically every place that you can name, oddly enough, to California, that the policies that he implemented were beneficial to pulling the United States and, incidentally, the world out of a depression. Now, you linked about a week ago, to a study by some economists out of UCLA that says, gosh, you know, we looked at that and doesn't happen to be true. So
right.
Why don't you talk about that a little bit? Tell us what it was that those guys found And then let's see where we are today and what kind of parallels there are.
Okay. Well, first of all, let's talk very briefly about the depression no one knows about. The depression of 1920. It was bad. The numbers were far worse than at any point during the Great Depression. The numbers were far worse than anything that is seen today or reasonably foreseen today. The government did not have the capability through a New Deal or Great Society and social safety net to do anything about it. It was over in 18 months. How long have we been in this Great Recession, for lack of a better term? What, are we going
2 years?
3 years?
Yeah, something like
two and a half, 3 years now?
Yeah.
The stock market topped in October of 2007. So with the government completely out of the way, people eventually got hungry, the plows started wearing out, people needed, and sooner or later, production picked up. As production picked up, people went back to work. As people went back to work, they bought. And the economy righted itself into, what did we remember and followed next? The Roaring Twenties. A great boom period where government didn't get involved and didn't make a mess. It was only when the government started messing with things and allowing the banks to do crazy things that we ended up with the Great Depression. And, of course, you know, when the final straw was when Hoover instituted the Smoot-Hawley tariff, which was basically the largest tax increase of all time, and created a trade war with the world that we rolled over finally into the Great Depression. Then Franklin Delano Roosevelt came in, and the first thing he did, of course, was seize great amounts of power that was unconstitutional. He had a number of fights with the Supreme Court. He stacked the Supreme Court with a couple of nominees that tipped it in his favor. And starting about 1934, he was able to pretty much do whatever he wanted, and Congress went along because they were all scared. And what all of Franklin Delano Roosevelt's programs were, he kept removing money from what could be used by private enterprise and creating these huge public works projects. Well, yes, those kept people working, but by creating a Keynesian model rather than a supply-side model for the economy, a Keynesian model that we've never really gotten away from ever since, we ended up with a slow and stagnant period because no growth comes from government projects. It's simply redistribution. It always has been.
Yes, absolutely.
We ended up with a depression that was extended 7 years according to that study. And, in fact, it took World War II really to get us out of it.
I'm going to throw a little heresy out here,
okay?
Because Keynes, for all of his faults and stuff, and everybody likes to talk about his propensity to spend by the government when the government is when demand is down.
The purchaser of last resort.
Yeah, what everybody forgets is the second part of that equation. And that is, when times are good, government needs to build up a surplus for that inevitable downturn again.
Right.
And everybody forgets that. Everybody only wants to quote Keynes when he talks about deficit spending for economic purposes. Nobody wants to remember when he talked about, but you need to build up the surpluses first.
Right, and the other part of Keynes was that he made it very clear that it was never designed to be a multi-generational economic model.
Exactly.
His deficit spending was to even out bumps in the road rather than to become a way of life with, you know, ever since the 1960s, we have been running the debt higher and higher and higher, and while I liked a great deal about Reagan, he did create some deficits. Now, in fairness to Reagan, his plan was to do the Keynes model, which was to do some deficit spending, get things going, you know, build up defense. That's a quick way to get a lot of people working. But the plan was to get some tax cuts and so forth along the way. He managed to get some, but not nearly what he wanted. And as a result, the economy did take off a little bit, but not nearly to the extent that it could have. Then you enter George H.W. Bush, and first thing he does is he's confronted with a minor recession, and his Read My Lips, No New Taxes pledge goes right out the window. He raises taxes, deepening that recession and slowing things down.
Yes,
enter Bill Clinton, the luckiest man on earth, because he rode the informational change, and it was a time of great growth. A monkey could have been in the White House and managed that economy.
Yes, absolutely. I was going to point that out.
And then you enter the dot-com bust, and the great boom of the informational age peaked. And as a result, we've been on a downward – we've been in a secular bear market since 2000. The average person doesn't realize that. But if you look at the real Dow in terms of constant dollars, the real peak of the market occurred in 2000 based on constant dollars. The dollar we're looking at now is deflated at a rate of 9 or 10% a year. So our dollar today is worth, 20-30%? I mean, I'm sorry, 60 or 70% of what it was in 2000.
Well, and you know, you can go back further and it'll break your heart because, you know, we're down to 2 and 3% of what the value used to be. And
there's been 212% inflation since 1982. I did this as part of a study on what stock prices should be. And since 1982, there's been from 1982 to 2007, there was well over 212% inflation.
Boy, if you don't understand numbers like that, you need to bone up a little bit because that kind of inflation will just absolutely kill you. And we can see that. So let's talk just a little bit then about parallels. We had the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act, which Hoover put in.
Right.
And that was, at that time, the largest tax increase in the history of the world.
Right.
We are looking at the end of this year, the non-renewal of the Bush tax cuts. Now, if that is true, if they are not renewed, that is a $1.3 to $1.6 trillion tax increase.
The largest on record.
Absolutely. I mean, you can make the argument all you want about, well, that's not really, it was designed to go out at that point in time, and, you know, it's not really a tax increase, it's just going back to the old rates. But, folks, let me tell you, if you have been living the last 8 years with those tax cuts in place, and all of a sudden your income is going to be taxed at a higher rate, as far as you're concerned, that's a tax increase. That is not...
Well, let's make it in simple terms. The grocery store puts on an 8-year sale on bread. Instead of charging $2 a loaf, it charges $1 a loaf. Suddenly, at the end of 8 years, they increase the loaf of bread back up to $2.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone sees that as a price increase.
Absolutely. Everybody. Doesn't matter if you're lib or conservative or anything else, that's a price increase. The same thing is true of these tax increases. So, if we saddle the American public with a $1.3 to $1.6 trillion tax increase, as we did, not to the same extent, but as we did with the Hoot-Smalley Tariff Act, what does that do to our economy? And if that does bad things, what do people do about that, if anything?
Well, remember that the Great Depression did not start overnight in October of 1929 with a stock market crash.
That's true.
The market fell, but it did not fall all the way down to its eventual bottom. It fell down in a long, sweeping period that took several months to complete. As it was starting to recover is when the Smoot-Hawley tariff came in, and that's what pushed it down to its eventual bottom, where it bumped along like a frog unable to jump for 7 to 10 years before it actually started to get any traction. Where we are right now is from October of 2007 down to the March lows of 2009, we had a long, sweeping, multi-month approximately 18-month recession-type drop in the market. That should have been the end of it, except that the government started getting involved. And as a result, they started running up debt. We had bubbles all over the place that hadn't popped, real estate, credit, et cetera. So nothing was there. All we have seen so far is a relief rally in a bear market up to the current highs. Now, we're poised to drop again, and it's just a matter of what is going to be the precipitating indicator that's going to hit. This week, we're going to have a number of economic indicators, and the big one's Friday. That'll be the jobs report for the month of June.
Mm-hmm.
So we could be looking at a rather bearish, I mean, they're expecting to lose at least 100,000 jobs out of the economy. Of course, with the number of people falling off the ends of the wealth of the, I won't say welfare, unemployment is not welfare, so it's gradually turning into it. But we're going to see a number of people fall off the back end of it and no longer be counted. And so as a result, we could actually see them junk the numbers up again like they have and bring the unemployment rate down a point or two, even though net jobs were lost. We've seen these reports. We've laughed at them in the past. 200,000 jobs fell out of the economy, but somehow the rate went from 10 to 9.7%.
You know,
so
and it
simply defies logic. You lost 200,000 jobs and the rate dropped 3%. It doesn't work. What it means is some people aren't being counted anymore.
You know, and that is a number that particularly bugs me. I mean, I'm, and we have had this discussion a couple of weeks ago about what the true unemployment rate is. And I came up with, I don't know, about 24, I think, something like that. Your friend, a noted economist, says, yeah, it's really about 21.5, 22, somewhere along the
22 and 22 and 3/8.
Yeah.
So
we're all
in the same ballpark on that.
Yeah, we are. But you know what? If we keep losing people like that, that true unemployment number has to be going up, cannot be going
up. And it is. It is.
And yet, no one seems to pay attention to that. I mean, everybody pays attention to the U1 number. Some more astute individuals will pay attention to the U6 number.
Mm-hmm.
But even the U6 number doesn't count the people that have dropped off.
And it doesn't count the birth-death ratio of businesses.
Nope. Certainly doesn't.
And if a business
and
is no longer reporting.
And that's got to be a horrific number. A horrific number. I mean.
Yeah, I just tweeted a number of charts from businessinsider.com tonight on Twitter showing that small business is really being put to the ringer. And I suggest you can, if you're listening, go back to my tweet stream and look for those, or go to businessinsider.com and find the article that shows what is really happening in small business. They're taking it on the chin, and 70% of new jobs are created in small business. So if we're going to fire up this economy, it's not going to happen from GE and IBM. It's going to start with Joe's Pizza Shack and Mary's Hair Salon and stuff like that.
Yes, it will. We have talked about the parallels, if any, between now and the Great Depression. We have talked about what generational shifts may have come about or coming about regarding that. So let's talk about going forward. Now, last week I did a monologue on perverse incentives and opened up the start of the show with my definition of perverse incentives, and also my definition of virtuous incentives. Perverse incentives are those incentives that not only do not but cannot achieve the stated goal. Virtuous incentives are those incentives that are congruent between expected behavior and outcomes. So, let's talk about what the virtuous incentives ought to be. And I will tell you that my usual co-host on this says, you know what, we ought to do a Tracy reset. And the Tracy reset is, you simply do not collect any taxes whatsoever for a year.
Mm-hmm. 1 year tax holiday.
All that money stays with whoever, producers, capital gains folks, corporations, who, it doesn't matter who.
It would create a deficit of about $2.8 trillion in 1 year, but it may reset the economy faster than this little deficit spending they're doing now.
And the fact of the matter is we've already spent more money than that in what are arguably non-productive fashions, i.e. perverse incentives.
We tweeted 100 different programs that actually cost jobs.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, if you can start out with the TARP plan, which morphed into something besides TARP, Troubled Asset Relief Program. You can then go to the stimulus program, which was $787 billion, call it $1 million with interest, or $1 trillion with interest. We went from that to cash to clunkers, which the only thing that did, and it a great example of a perverse incentive, folks should have seen what that was going to do, which was you're going to take people who would have bought cars anyway, and you're going to get them to move their purchase up. And by the way, you're also going to take off their perfectly good used car that is now no longer going to be on the market, and
destroy
you're going
it.
To destroy that.
Yep.
Now,
and you get a 5.9 jump in GDP.
Oh, boy.
Quarter.
Exactly. And so then we decide that we're going to do the same thing with appliances. Now, I'm probably as green as anybody in that, you know, I don't purposely, you know, dump my oil from my oil changes out on the ground, and I don't spray stuff on my fields, and I'm green in that sense. I am not green in the sense that if I'm the EPA, I want to regulate dust on farms.
Yeah. Well, let me point out another perverse incentive.
Okay.
As you put it, I call it the law of unintended consequences. Same idea.
Yeah, that too.
this first-time buyer's tax credit.
Yes.
Cost $20 billion. It gave a 1 or 2 month jump in home sales. May and June were the worst 2 months on record since they started keeping the records in 1963. Annualized sales of 300,000 homes is worse than back to 1963. Now think about that. How many families did we have in 1963 versus today? That tells you in real terms just how bad the housing market is, and yet they blew $20 billion on a program that got people into houses where they're already 30% of them are underwater. Why? Because if housing is falling at the rate of 14 or 15% a year, and you put 5% down like a good Fannie Mae FHA mortgage requires, you're 10% underwater by the end of a year. What did that $8,000 tax credit do?
Nothing. Nothing.
By the way, one of your listeners, Louisa May, asked what the U6 number is. I happened to pick up her tweet stream.
Oh, yeah.
The U6 number, Louisa, is the total number of people who are on unemployment, those who are underemployed, and those who are considered to be discouraged workers who are no longer receiving unemployment. That number is hovering around 18% right now. And then if you add in the birth-death ratio of businesses that does not get picked up except for an annual adjustment, we're looking at about 22 3/8, according to Bob Chapman, a very famous international forecaster and economist. So I hope that answers your question, Louisa, and please follow me on Twitter. I'll be glad to talk with you about it more in the future.
Yeah. You know, if we talk about virtuous incentives, what are the things that we could do? I mean, obviously, a reauthorization of the Bush tax cuts would be in order. That would be a virtuous thing to do. Wouldn't change anything from right now, but it would take some uncertainty out of not only the market, but expectations by the general public. What else could we do? I mean, are there regulations that we could roll back? I mean, here's a for instance. I read last week and this week that Ken Salazar, the head of Interior, and MMS, Mineral, oh gosh, forgot it, MMS, Mineral Management Services.
Yeah, there you go.
Has taken 33 exploratory options off the table in a western state.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if we are looking to bring down the price of oil and oil derivatives and those products that are priced based on oil, which would be like propane, then wouldn't it make more sense to discover them and, having discovered them, put them in production? I mean, is there something wrong with that thinking that says we need to increase our ability to provide our own energy, and yet we take those tracts of land and say, no, we're not even going to explore them?
Well, we do one thing better. We just put them under government ownership. Utah is 60% owned by the federal government. I think Nevada is somewhere around 80% owned by the federal government. We are the Saudi Arabia of coal and oil shale. There is more than enough energy in this country to fuel us for well over 100 years while we figure out how to get a car to travel across the country on either a small fusion reactor, or because the Volt's not going to get it.
40 miles on a charge just doesn't
take
it for me.
It's going to take you 5 days to travel across the United States if you slept the 30 minutes you got an 80% charge on the battery. It's not going to work. You cannot move freight with it. You cannot move groceries with it. You can't move drywall with it. The electric motor is not here yet. And honestly, all these wind and solar projects are a waste of time anyway, because, yes, they may produce electricity, but there's one technology that has not caught up, and I'm not sure it will for quite a while, and that's battery technology. You can generate all the electricity you want during the day with solar. Fantastic idea.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it's got to be released slowly overnight through batteries.
Yep.
And wind is fantastic, but it doesn't blow. And, you know, all these great glowing numbers for wind farms only yield about 60% efficiency at best due to battery.
Yep. And of course, nukes are off the table. I mean, that's not considered a renewable resource, although, frankly, it is. Hydro is off the table. That is not considered a renewable resource. And I have to tell you, that reasoning absolutely escapes me. I just, you know, it doesn't make any sense to me at all. It rains every year. The snowpack falls every year. The reservoirs fill up every year, and you're trying to tell me that, no, this is not a renewable resource. I'm sorry. Corn grows every year. I suppose that's a renewable resource, but I have this fundamental abhorrence of using food for fuel. I mean, it just does not make any sense to me. I saw a report today that said wheat futures were dramatically up.
Yeah, Russia's in a great drought.
One of
the
they?
Greatest droughts in over 130 years. That's what that's what I heard on I listen to business news while I'm out during the day on Sirius Radio, and and what's happened is that's what's caused the wheat futures to go through the roof, which will of course lead to higher prices for bread and cereal and so forth here or down the road. But yeah, I agree with you. Second of all, ethanol creates more greenhouse gases than it saves.
Well, that's true.
It's become a highly subsidized industry, And we all know what happens with any government program. Ronald Reagan said it's the closest thing to eternal life. We'll never get rid of them, like the farm subsidies and all the other subsidies that are out there. And, of course, there are documented cases where burning corn, basically turning it into alcohol and burning it in our cars, has led to increased starvation in poorer countries who relied on our cheap corn as a food source.
You know,
and finally,
I
filled my truck one time with E85 when I was driving through Missouri, and it was all ethanol. I normally get 18 miles to the gallon. That sounds terrible to some liberal listening, but I got 11 on that stuff.
Oh, man.
And I was pumping out more greenhouse gases than ever, so
yeah,
I will never fill my truck with E85 ethanol again.
No, I tell you, I'm, you know, all of my rigs that I drive on a daily basis are diesel. Which, you know, at the time that I made that decision was a good bet, and now it isn't so much, but oh well. And we have talked about, and we've got about 5 minutes, we talked about things that pertain to the U.S., but you brought up an interesting point, and that is this. The actions that we take for the United States have a very direct impact on other countries, and particularly underdeveloped, less developed, and not at all developed countries. So when we take corn and we turn it into alcohol and burn it, when we have multi-year droughts, and incidentally, 100-year droughts are not unknown in California. So just be aware that that's true. The things that can go wrong don't necessarily impact us right here today other than in increased unrest in the rest of the world. So if that's true, it seems to me that we have... one, an obligation to look at what do our policies do, not only for ourselves, but particularly for food sources for other countries.
Mm-hmm.
And two, if that's true, do the current policies in force have that effect?
Well, the current policies right now... our current energy policy when it comes to ethanol is a sham. It's a joke. It should be really considered criminal, because all it's doing is propping up, creating an industry out of thin air that doesn't need to be there.
Mm-hmm.
It's inefficient. It wastes food, and it produces no useful result other than to make somebody feel good that we're using renewable corn. Let me tell you something.
Right.
I'm sure that all the methane inside the planet is renewable, too. We just haven't figured out how to get at all the pockets of methane under the ocean floor. But let me tell you, if we ever do, we got enough methane hydrate down there to power every one of us off the planet in a rocket ship to Mars. Okay, so
There you go.
We've got energy on this planet, and I honestly believe that it's been put there for a reason. I'm not going to delve too far into the creationist idea, but I don't think this is all an accident, and I think it's simply a matter we need to pull our heads out of where the darkness is and figure out where we want to go when we go forward, and we're going to have to look at that this November. That's going to be very key to the future of this nation.
Absolutely. We've got a half a minute left. Greg, if you want to do any shout-outs to folks and say hi and tune in and all that kind of stuff, now would be the time to do it.
Well, I want to thank just me, Pammy, and Louisa for their comments. I'm watching them come across the Twitter screen. Really appreciate the listening, and I appreciate the chance that you get me to get on this show and get outside of 140 characters, because it can be a little bit frustrating sometimes to try and explain macroeconomics in a tweet.
Absolutely.
I'd like to ask that if you want to hear more about this, join us Thursday night on httpcpnlive.com. That's Conservative Political Network. Let's see what time, 7 o'clock Eastern time. And I'll be on there with Bob Chapman, who I've talked about, and Stan Solomon. And we'll get into this macroeconomic stuff in more detail than maybe you want, but it'll be good to hear.
Super. Greg, thank you so much for coming on tonight. I certainly appreciate that. It was a great discussion. And I'd like to have you back on again sometime.
Anytime.
All righty. Thank you, Greg. Take care now.
Thank you.
All right. Bye now.